Okay, we are going to talk about Genesis 9 through 11 today in this podcast or audio file. And Genesis 9 through 11 is the tail end of the flood narrative. So we have the ending of the flood in chapter 9, which we touched on a little bit last time. And then chapter 10 is typically called the Table of Nations. That's where the sons of Noah are laid out to demonstrate through the narrative, you know, where people come from. And the idea is in chapter 10 is that there's 70 descendants of Noah through his wife and his sons, Japheth, Ham, and Shem, or Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And out of these 70 come the 70 different peoples. And so different authors in the Bible will refer back to this table to try to describe the beginnings of the different peoples in the Old Testament narrative. And this is also used to describe the enemies of the Israelites. And one of the big enemies in the Old Testament narrative is going to be the Canaanites. And so we'll kind of take a look at that. And then chapter 11 is the narrative of the Tower of Babel. And then at the conclusion of the Tower of Babel narrative, we are introduced to this guy by the name of Abram, who we typically know today as Abraham. And so that is Genesis 9 through 11 in a nutshell. Pretty simple. So chapter 9, we've had the flood and Noah and his sons come down out of the ark, the teba, this boat, as it were. And it says in verse 1 that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air and upon all that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb have I given you all these things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. And surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of every man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. And then we get into these Noahide covenants, the covenants that God gives Noah, essentially saying, hey, these are the things that you can do, these are the things that you can't do. We talked about these last time, so I'll be brief, but there's basically 7 of them. Don't deny God, don't blaspheme God, don't murder, don't engage in illicit sexual relations, do not steal, don't eat from a live animal, and create a legal system of justice. These Noahide laws essentially come out of rabbinic Judaism, and they come out of the traditions of the Jews, because specifically in Genesis 9, 3 through 7, this stuff isn't explicitly stated. For example, to be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth in verse 7, well, it doesn't say to not engage in illicit sexual relations, but that is the intent, and that's the way the Jews described it. And the idea of not denying God is not really in verses 3 through 7 of chapter 9 explicitly stated, but it's obliquely stated in the sense of it's God speaking to Noah, God's establishing his covenant. And so some of these texts where the Jews explain this stuff, they say that, you know, since God is the one doing this, you can't desecrate God and you have to be careful with his name. And so these ideas are derived from Judaism out of other texts, but they're called the Noahide laws. In other words, these are the 7 laws that non-Jews are supposed to live. So there's 613 laws in the Old Testament, but if you're not Jewish, you got to follow these 7. God's going to establish the token of the covenant in verse 12 and 13 with the bow. Verse 12, and God said, this is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said to Noah, this is a token of the covenant which I established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. And so that's the covenant, this idea that he's not going to flood the earth again. Sometimes people ask questions about the rainbow as a sign and what to do with it. In teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith made a couple different references. In one of them, he said, "The Lord has set the bow in the cloud for a sign that while it shall be seen, seed time and harvest, summer and winter shall not fail, but when it shall disappear, woe to that generation, for behold, the end cometh quickly." That's teachings, page 305. Another time, Joseph Smith said, "I've asked the Lord concerning his coming, and while asking the Lord, he gave a sign and said, in the days of Noah, I set a bow in the heavens as a sign and token that in any year that the bow should be seen, the Lord would not come. But there should be seed time and harvest during that year. But whenever you see the bow withdrawn, it shall be a token that there shall be famine, pestilence, and great distress among the nations, and that the coming of the Messiah is not far distant." That's teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, page 340 to page 341. So Joseph talked a little bit about this. As far as, you know, what do we do with this? I think it's just a great story to talk about God and to talk about how this happened or something like this happened. In our class, in our Zoom meeting, we talked about the literal nature of this and how literal was it. I certainly don't think that the entire world was flooded, as it were, but I do see this as a representation of recreation. And so in the slides I'll put out there, there's a really good one that shows the firmament and the waters above the firmament and the waters beneath. And by the waters collapsing on the created order, by the waters crushing and coming through the rakia above the earth and coming from underneath the earth through Sheol, through the depths of the earth, the abyss underneath, it's this recreation, and the chaos comes through. The water represents this primeval ocean, this water of chaos, and it just comes through and crushes everything. And so what it does is we're doing like a recreation. So this would make like Noah would be like a second Adam. So, and I may have mentioned this in the last podcast, the last audio file we did, but John Taylor in Journal of Discourses, volume 26, talked about the earth being immersed. And then I gave another quote by John Walton. John Walton's a Bible scholar, not LDS. But he says that the text, by talking about the cosmology the way it does, it could have been a localized flood and totally fit in the mindset of the authors of this text, which I like. He says, Genesis 8, 3 through 5, the tops of the mountains are visible. This is the most difficult statement to explain for those arguing that the text does not require a global flood. In saying that the tops of the mountains became visible, this verse conveys that the tops, not just the flanks of the mountains, had been obscured. If it were not for chapter 8, 3 through 5, an interpreter could easily claim that the face on face value of the text, that it does not demand a geographically global flood. All the other statements are compatible with a flood of the known populated world. We must still consider whether chapter 8, 3 through 5 strikes us the way it does because we are thinking in terms of our understanding of the world. Would this text have meant something different if we could read it with an ancient Near Eastern mindset? In the Mesopotamian worldview, the known world was comprised of a single continent fringed with mountains, such as the Zagros on the east and the mountains of Ararat in the north, and ringed by a cosmic sea. The fringe mountains were believed to hold up the heavens and have roots in the netherworld. In the east, the mountain primarily associated with this role is Mount Masu. What happens if we try to read the flood narrative against the background of this sort of worldview? Is it possible that the ancient writers did not count the mountains at the fringes of the world among the high mountains that the water covered? Cosmic mountains were places of the gods and would be impervious to floodwaters sent by the gods. In this scenario, the ark drifts to the edge of the known world and rests against the mountains of Ararat, or perhaps the foothills of Ararat. Noah views this as the edge of the world, just as some before Columbus's day believed they could reach the edge of the world. There the ark sits, with the water recedes, while the water recedes and the tops of the mountains in the occupied portion of the continent become visible. This means that when the waters totally dissipate, the ark is at the foot of the Ararat chain. The logic of not including the fringe mountains is that they were believed to support the heavens, and the waters are not seen as encroaching on or encountering the heavens. This way of thinking yields a flood of the then known world, with boundaries as described, for instance, in the Sargon geography and in the list of Noah's descendants in Genesis 10. It covered all the elevated places that were within eyesight of the occupants of the ark. Though this would be geographically a limited flood, it could still be anthropologically universal if people had not yet spread beyond this region. One of the advantages of seeking out views such as this is that they allow us to affirm the truth of the text without getting tied up in complicated logistical and scientific discussions. So I like that. Probably going to say it another way here. So here it is. John Walton gives a really good explanation in his NIV application commentary where he says this. Listen, if you just read this text through the lens of the authors that wrote this, it could be described as a global flood because based on what they understand and stood about the world, the whole world would have been the area they lived and the mountains that they saw off in the distance would have been that which had held up the firmament, which held up the firmament, and the firmament held the chaos waters above it. And so to them, that would have been the whole world. I think we talked about this on Thursday where we said, when it says that Caesar Augustus taxed the whole world was not the whole world the way you and I describe it, but the Empire of Rome. And so this is another way to read the flood narrative. Anyway, I hope that's worth it. I hope that's worth a little bit of discussion there on Genesis 9. We talked a little bit last time about this curse that happens in Genesis 9, where Ham sees his father's nakedness and then Canaan is cursed in verse 25. I just want to share this idea that Canaan is a descendant of Ham. The question of who were the Canaanites? They were a group of people that lived in the land of Canaan during the time that the Bible was textualized. Probably in the 7th century. They're mentioned 150 times at least in the Old Testament. They're described as wicked, idolatrous, descending from Noah's grandson Canaan, who was a son of Ham. That's going to be Genesis 9:18. This is what it says. And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham is the father of Canaan. And from Canaan we get the Canaanites. And they're going to be cursed because they're always fighting against God. The Canaanites is used more broadly to refer to all the inhabitants of the land, specifically the Hivites, Girgashites, Jebusites, Amorites, Hittites, and Perizzites. You're going to read that description in Judges 1, 9 through 10. I give you in the slides under the Table of Nations, you can see it right there in the middle of the Table of Nations, Genesis 10 slide, you'll see Ham. To the right of his genealogy of Canaan, and then you have the sons of Canaan, Sidon, Heth, the Jebusites, Amorites, Girgashites, Hivites, etc. So those are the tribes and the group of people that are associated with the Canaanites. And these guys are always fighting against the Israelites. In Numbers 13, they're fighting. They're always fighting with Moses and his people. And there's a lot of campaigns against them in Judges and in Joshua. And so these guys are definitely like the bad guys, or at least one of them in the Old Testament. And so the idea of Canaan being cursed in Genesis 9, I think we talked about this, but it's essentially one way to denigrate a group of people is to denigrate their ancestor. And so by denigrating Ham and Canaan, the authors of the text are issuing a polemic against them. And so that's why it says in verse 27, God shall enlarge Japheth. He shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And then you get into this idea of Noah living for a long time. It says Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So no more Noah. And then we get to chapter 10, the generations of Noah. And this is, like we said earlier, the Table of Nations. Couple things of note. You'll note verse 21, unto Shem also the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth, the elder, even to them were children born. A lot of people say that that's where we get the term Hebrew, that a Hebrew is someone who is of Eber. And so from Shem and from Eber, we get Abraham. Abraham's going to come out of that family. You get another interesting verse, verse 25. And to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. One of the things with Peleg's name is it's a pun. And we see this a lot in the Bible where names can mean things and it can be kind of a dad joke. And so it says in verse 25, the name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and Peleg is division. And so his name means division. So it's a pun. It's just kind of a joke. With Peleg comes the departure point between the two branches of Shem in chapter 10 and 11. Here the genealogy traces the family of Peleg rather than his brother Joktan. Love that name. Joktan was the father of the Arabian tribes, while Peleg was the progenitor of the northwestern Mesopotamian family. So in the Table of Nations, Peleg, while generating this pun that associates his heir with the momentous but now cryptic event, because in his time the earth was divided, when we count Abraham as the 10th member of the Shem line, Peleg occupies like this halfway point right in the line of Shem. He's like number 5. We can't be certain, but if the folk etymology of chapter 10, verse 25 ties his generation to the tower event, then the dispersion is situated at the midpoint between Shem and the era of Abraham. So that's kind of cool. Another striking feature of Peleg's role is the sudden reduction in the years of lifespan, 239 compared to his father, 464, and grandfather, 433. Why? This may underscore that during the Peleg era, if it were contemporaneous with the Babel generation, that it was particularly impacted by the sin of this age. It just depends on how you read it. But the one thing you can get out of this is there's a pun going on. They're having some fun. He's kind of this halfway point here in the line. And also, you'll note, we get this dude named Nimrod. I remember growing up, we kind of used Nimrod as kind of a way to make fun of somebody. We'd say, oh, you're such a Nimrod. If you look in verse 8 and 9, it says that there's this guy named Nimrod, and he comes from Cush, which comes from Ham, and he's a mighty one in the earth, a mighty hunter before the Lord. That's the phrase that's used there. The Joseph Smith translation indicates not that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, but that he was a mighty hunter in the land. That's Genesis 10:5 in the Joseph Smith translation. So this is right, what I'm going to read to you guys is right out of the Institute manual. It says, though the words are not definite, it's very likely that he was a bad guy. His name Nimrod comes from Marad, or he rebelled. And the Targum, an ancient Jewish translation or paraphrasing of the scriptures on 1 Chronicles chapter 1 verse 10 says, Nimrod began to be a mighty man in sin, a murderer of innocent men, and a rebel before the Lord. The Jerusalem Targum says, he was mighty in hunting or in prey and in sin before God. He was a hunter of the children of men in their languages. And he said to them, depart from the religion of Shem and cleave to the institutes of Nimrod. These Targums, you know, in the Institute manual doesn't really explain what the Targum is, but the Targums were essentially scriptures that were interpreted during a time period specifically after Jesus when the temple's destroyed. So the temple's destroyed in 70 AD, and the synagogue kind of replaces religious services for these people that read the Old Testament. And a lot of the Jews weren't reading Hebrew at the time. They were speaking and reading Greek and Aramaic and some of these languages. And so a Targum was a translation of the scriptures into the language the people spoke. Like I said, specifically, a lot of times it was Aramaic. And the person who translated it and kind of gave his inspired commentary was called a meturgeman, or professional interpreter. And that's where we get the name Targum. It kind of comes out of this idea, the name for the interpreter. It's kind of like podcasting before podcasting. 2,000 years ago, you know, especially if the scriptures weren't in your language, you would kind of have to have somebody explain it to you. And so that's what these Targums were. These Targums were explanations in the language that people spoke of the scriptures. And so a lot of the Targums are just a collection of these traditions. And so in tradition, like I said, this is not in the scriptural text of Genesis, but in the tradition of the day, Nimrod was a bad guy. Some of the Targums refer to him as a giant. The Syriac calls him, in one of the Syriac versions, he's called a warlike giant. The word Sa'id, which we render as hunter, signifies prey, and it's applied in the scriptures to the hunting of men by persecution, oppression, and tyranny. Hence, it is likely that Nimrod, having acquired power, used it in tyrannical ways. He used it in tyranny and oppression, and by rapine and violence founded that dominion which was the first distinguished by the name of a kingdom on the face of the earth. That's right out of the Institute Manual, the Old Testament Institute Manual, that's quoting Clark's Biblical Commentary, Volume 1, page 86. This is from the Institute Manual, page 58. Thus, in the same patriarchal age, Melchizedek established a Zion after the pattern of Enoch, the prototype of the true city of God, the freest of all societies. And Nimrod established a Babylon that gave us its name to the prototype of the kingdom of Satan, the antithesis of Zion. And so Nibley talks about this in Lehi in the Desert, page 154 to 164. And all of these ideas are swirling around in chapter 10. And chapter 10 doesn't really give us the whole story. It just, you know, we get this couple verses about this guy named Nimrod, a little bit about this guy named Eber, the earth's divided. And then it says at the end in verse 31 of chapter 10, these are the sons of Shem after their families, after their tongues and the lands, after the nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations and their nations, and by these are the nations divided in the earth after the flood. And so from an Old Testament biblical perspective, that's this idea of, you want to know where people come from? Then just read Genesis 10. Genesis 10 is going to explain all you need to know about how we got people and how we got nations and the languages. And once again, this is what Genesis is. It's describing beginnings. It's describing how things came to be. And then you get to chapter 11, which is the final chapter we're going to cover today. And this chapter is all about the Tower of Babel. And so it says, everybody was of one speech in verse 1. And verse 3 says, they said one to another, go, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build up a city and a tower whose top may reach to heaven. And let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the whole face of the earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build their city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. And so that's it. That's the Tower of Babel. Not a lot of explanation. The Book of Mormon gives us a little bit more stuff, right? Essentially, in addition to providing an explanation for the numerous languages now found on the earth, this account of the Tower of Babel shows how quickly men forgot the lessons of the flood and turned again from the Lord. The Book of Mormon shows that the actual confounding languages may not have been instantaneous, but it may have happened over like a period of time. Jared asks his brother to call upon the Lord and request that their language not be confounded. This request was granted. Then Jared asked his brother to plead that the language of their friends may stay the same as theirs, and this too was granted. You can read all this at the end of chapter 1 of Ether, verse 33 through 38. These events imply that the confounding of the languages didn't happen instantaneously. Now, what do we do with this? I think there's a lot of ways to read this. To me, this is a polemic against Babylon. And so in the slides I'm going to share with you guys, there's quite a few of them, of the vast size of Babylon. The name Babylon literally means the gate of God. The Hebrews are going to change this idea of Babel. Instead of meaning the gate of God, it's going to mean mixed or confused. And so the authors of the Old Testament even take the gate of God, Babel, Bab-El, from gate of God to being mixed or confused. To the authors of the Old Testament, to the people that put these texts together, Babylon was a big deal. They were huge, huge enemies. And the center of Babylon was this massive temple to Marduk, who was this god in their pantheon who slew Chaos, slew the Leviathan, and issued order. And the Jews, they do not like Marduk. They do not like the people of Babylon. And so this is definitely a polemical text against them. And it's a way to say, oh, you think you can build a tower to get to heaven? Well, what is a tower? A tower to get to heaven, that's a temple. And so it's kind of an attack against anybody who builds a false temple. And that's one way to read the beginnings here of Genesis 11, as it's an attack against those that have different religious convictions. And the authors are saying, no, we know the way. We know the gate of God. Yours is confusion. Ours is the right way. And we talked about this earlier in our last audio file, but that's a lot of what Scripture does, is it's a polemic against other religious traditions that smack against the one writing the story, right? And that's kind of what history is too, right? It's the story of the people that are writing, and if it's agreed upon, the victors win and the losers are kind of lost to history. And so that's what we read here, in my opinion, of Genesis 11. This story of the Tower of Babel also lays out a couple of interesting things about God as well. Notice verse 7 of chapter 11. This is what happens. It says, "Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." And then it says in verse 8, "The Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth." What I want to draw your attention to is verse 7, where it says, "Let us go down." This is multiple divine beings. We see this again in Genesis 1, 26 through 28. "Let us create man in our image." Multiple divine beings on this divine council talking to each other. And I also like to read this story of the Tower of Babel as a beginning story. We've got to, the authors of the text, the people who put this together, they have to describe the beginnings of all these different people. Why do we have people that live in other places that look different than us, that talk different than us? And so Genesis is grappling with these ideas, trying to explain them, trying to explain how these things happen and what's going on. From basically chapter 11, verse 10, to verse 26 is a bunch of genealogy of these people. What we're doing is we're tying in Abraham to Adam. And so we go through all these people, and then finally we get to verse 26. It says, "Terah lived 70 years and beget Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And these are the generations of Terah." All the way to verse 26 is where we're going to get to. It says, "Terah lived 70 years and beget Abram. And these are the generations of Terah," verse 27. "Terah beget Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." And that's it. You know, that's the beginning of Abram in chapter 12. He's going to be introduced to God. He's going to make a covenant with God. The book of Abraham, which we're not going to do in this podcast, but the book of Abraham is going to blow up so many of these early traditions about Abram that are scattered throughout all these extra biblical texts about who he is. We learn more about Terah and his idolatry. We learn more about Abram and his experience with the pharaohs in Egypt. And so there's a lot of this stuff that's in the book of Abraham that's not in the Old Testament account. But one of the things Genesis 11 is trying to do is to tie in these old stories into what are called the patriarchs. And the patriarchs are going to be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the matriarchs are going to be their wives. The wives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, these individuals, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, are going to form the backbone of the Genesis narrative of who we are. It's tying us into, we are the sons and daughters of these individuals that walked and talked with God. And they then are tied into big heroes of the Old Testament, like Noah and his family and Adam and Eve. And so this, in our third podcast, is this introduction of Abraham and who he is, tied into and through the story of Babel, this word that means the gate of God, that the authors of the Genesis account are going to say it's just a bunch of confusion. And notice, even in the way it's described in the third verse of chapter 11, where they make their bricks, they're just all the same and they're sun-baked. And I remember listening to this one rabbi explain this, where he said that the altars that God has the patriarchs make are made of unhewn stones. we get this idea of altars and unhewn stones in the Exodus 20 narrative, where, and there's different translations. The New Living Translation says, if you use stones to build my altar, use only natural uncut stones. Do not shape the stones with a tool, for that would make the altar unfit for holy use. Or the King James Version, and if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. And this rabbi explained, in Babylon, everything's made with these bricks, and they're perfectly made, and they're perfectly shaped with the tools of men, because we're all the same. But to the altars of God, the altars are made, at least in the Exodus 20 narrative, the altars are made with unhewn stone, meaning that each stone is this individual type thing. Like, God sees us as individuals. And in the world of Babylon, in the world of Master Mahan or Cain, the antithesis of Zion, in these societies where we're just numbers, we're kind of like a brick. And this kind of bleeds into the Exodus narrative, right? Where the Pharaoh just says, make a ton of bricks, just keep making them. And he's whipping the Hebrews and he's like, get to work. And they have to make all these bricks. And these people are just slaves. They're just a number. And to God, we are not numbers. We're individuals. And so I like that idea that there are these two societies. There's the city of Enoch, which we don't even get in the Bible, right? We read about this in the Moses narrative. And in the city of Enoch, God sees them as individuals. And the Lord called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. And yet in Babel, or in the gate of God, or as the writers are going to call it, the gate of confusion, the house of confusion, we're just a brick. We're just a number. And so, you know, how are you viewed? And so my testimony, you guys, is that God sees you as an individual. And we don't see this in any greater color or any greater technicolor, as it were, than in the story of Abraham or Abram and Sarai. These two individuals are highly individualistic people, and God's going to work with them on their level. And the stories that they have, and we're going to pull out some of these stories that are maybe not even in the Bible, especially with Sarah, because to me, she's such a critical character. We're going to pull some of these stories out of these extra biblical texts, and we'll probably draw some of this from Abraham too, as well, as we go into the stories of this great patriarch and this great matriarch and see them as the epitome of what it means to be a follower of Christ. And so with that, thanks for listening, and we'll see you on Thursday night.